What we're going to do now is actually have a reading by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. Well, a reading. It's on point. She's a philosopher, novelist, author of 8 books, including the novels, including The Mind-Body Problem, which she also did her last non-fiction book was called Betraying Spinoza, and the one before that was Incompleteness, The Proof and Paradox of Kurt Gödel. And her current work in progress, which she's going to read from, she doesn't usually do this, so we're very pleased about this, is 33 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. Rebecca Neuberger.
Hi. Well, so yes, I've never actually done this, read from a work that's still in progress, and I'm very nervous about doing it. The reason I decided to do it was just because it seemed so very apt for the sorts of things that we're talking about. So the book is called 33 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction, and it does actually have an appendix in which I have 33 arguments all analyzed, all shown to be fallacious. In fact, there are more than 33. I wanted to say 33 because it's alliterative, but I actually thought of many more, and so I had to sort of group them together. And each chapter is has a different title, the argument from, well, I'm going to read from the first chapter. It's called The Argument from the Improbable Self. Anyway, it's about a man who's written a book on atheism, and it's become a runaway bestseller. But he has, of course, we novelists like inner conflict, and so my atheist, who's called Cass Seltzer, has transcendental tendencies that he constantly has to push down. And actually, you'll get a little taste of this, and whether his transcendentalism is something that is incompatible with atheism or not is not clear, and it's not clear to me either. It might be, for example, what Spinoza was talking about when he talks about this kind of rationalist bliss that radical objectivity can lead to. Anyway, I'm just going to read a little bit from it, and another theme that I want to explore in the book is the way in which romantic love can simulate certain features of religious enchantment. Romantic love is a kind of delusion, and nobody wants to be undiluted about that. The last thing, this is my 9th book, and I've always had this ambition to write a book that would use the word luction. And those of you who are culturally and culinarily deprived, luction means noodles in Yiddish. And well, I finally managed to do it with this one. So, The Argument from the Improbable Self. Something shifted, something so immense you could call it the world. Call it the world. The world shifted, catching lots of smart people off guard, churning up issues that they thought had settled down forever below the Earth's crust. The more sophisticated you are, the more annotated your mental life, the more taken aback you more than likely feel, seeing what the world's lurch has brought to light, thrusting up all manner of beliefs and desires that you'd assume belonged to some earlier stage of human development. The world shifted, exactly when you aren't quite sure, but definitely some displacement that's disclosed what you hadn't guessed was there. What is this stuff, you ask one another, and how can it still be kicking around, given how much we already know? It looks like the kind of relics that archaeologists dig up and dust off, speculating about the world wonders and superstitions that once had animated them to the best that they can be reconstructed, gone as they are now, those thrashings of proto-rationality and mythico-magical hypothesizing, and all but forgotten. Now it's all gone unforgotten, and minds with better things to think about have to divert precious neuronal resources to figuring out how to knock some sense back into the species. It's a tiresome proposition, having to take up the work of the Enlightenment all over again. But it's happened on your watch, this global genuflection toward pre-dawn, and it's fallen to you to figure out the counter-charm. You and your kind ought to have been paying some attention, sending up a balloon now and then to get a read on the prevailing cognitive conditions. Even if you are the laureated physicist, Steven Weinberg, say, and so having your hands full, what with the 10 to the 500 universes that string theory has delivered onto your screen, leaving you to have to make up your mind as to whether the number is 10 to the 500th minus 1 too many, or maybe just about right. Or you're the cognitive scientist, Steven Pinker, reverse engineering how the forces of evolution shape the computational modules of the mind and how it all got wired into the brain by way of the genes. You stevedores of science have all been thinking about what you wanted to think about. And the upshot is you've let the stockpiling of fallacies reach dangerous levels so that now the massed weapons of the logic threaten the survivability of the globe. None of this is particularly good for the world, but it has been good for Cass Seltzer. That's what he's thinking at this moment out in the middle of a marrow freezing night in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and taking a wide angled gaze at the improbable swerve his life has lately taken. He's thinking his life is better because the world is going badly. He's thinking the zealots proliferate and Seltzer prospers. It's 4 a.m. and Cass Seltzer is standing on the graceful arc of a footbridge that spans the Charles River near Harvard University, staring down at the river below, which is in the rigor mortis of late February in New England. It's not like Seltzer to be out in the middle of an icy night, to brave the harsh elements and possible muggers, lost in thought while losing sensation in his extremities. He hadn't been able to fall asleep and finally had just called off the effort and crawled out from under the comforter that Lucinda had brought with her when she moved in with him 19 weeks ago. This comforter is, just as Lucinda herself is, akin to a revelation, with pockets for the hands and feet and a softness that's the result of impregnation with aloe vera, making it all the more remarkable that Cass would forsake it for this no man's stretch of frigid night. Lucinda's away tonight, away for the entire bleak week to come, which is significantly their 20th together. Cass is missing Lucinda in his bones, missing her in the marrow that's crystallizing into ice. She's in warmer climes at a conference in Santa Barbara on Nunn-Nash equilibria and zero-sum games. Lucinda's a high flyer in game theory. Technically, she's a psychologist, but her work is so mathematical that you hardly suspect it has anything to do with humans. From the way that Lucinda had described it, it's a pretty high-powered conference going on in Santa Barbara, and Lucinda's the keynote speaker. She'd been sure to mention that fact to him at least 4 times, and he'd taken it as a hint and cleared his own heavy lecture schedule so that he could accompany her, only to be told that she'd rather that he didn't. He tried not to sound hurt or alarmed when he'd asked her why not. "Well, it just doesn't make sense," she said. "I don't go traipsing after you on your junkets, do I? It would be one thing if there was an overlap between your work and mine, but we both know there's not. So the sole reason for why you'd come along would be simply to accompany me." She delivered that last line as if it were the final step of an reductio ad absurdum. Not thinking much of where he was heading, he'd headed straight for Harvard Square and then down to the river and then up onto Weeks Bridge, dead center, which seemed to be the spot that he'd been seeking. The night is so cold that everything seems to have been stripped bare of superfluous existence, reduced to the purity of abstraction. Cass has the distinct impression that he can see better in the sharpened air, that the cold is counteracting the nearsightedness that's had him wearing glasses since he was 12. He takes off his frameless glasses and, of course, can't see a thing, can barely see past the nimbus phantom of his own breath. But then he stares harder, and it seems that he can see better. It's only now, with his glasses off, that he catches sight of the spectacle that the extreme cold has created in the river below. frozen solid except where it quickens through the three graceful arches of the bridge's substructure, creating an effect that could reasonably be called sublime, and in the Kantian sense, not cozily beautiful, but touched by a metaphysical chill. Standing dead center on Weeks Bridge, in the dead of winter, in the dead of night, staring down at the three enormous arches, sublimely carved into the churl, suggesting a cathedral shaped into the ice, Cass is contemplating the strange thing that his life has become. To him, his life's become strange to him. He feels like he's wearing somebody else's coat, grabbed in a hurry from the heaped bed in the spare bedroom after a boozy party. He's walking around in someone else's bespoke cashmere while that guy has Seltzer's hooded parka, and only Seltzer seems to have noticed the switch. Cass Seltzer is a psychologist of religion who's been puttering away for years at his own private obsessions, from Neoplatonic influences on Christian and Jewish Gnosticism to the Kabbalistic symbolism of traditional Jewish foods like potato kugel and lakshin, without anyone much taking any notice at all. But now, within the last year, he's become a member of a circle so select that its number rarely ranges far from zero, most especially in the US. Cass Seltzer has become an intellectual celebrity. He's become famous for his abstract ideas, and not just any old abstract ideas, but atheist abstract ideas, which makes him, according to some of the latest polls, a spokesperson for the most distrusted minority in America, the one that most Americans are least willing to allow their children to marry. Yes, it's true, apparently, that atheists have become the fairies, kikes, and commies of yesteryear, and Cass Seltzer has become the unlikely poster boy for this misunderstood and abused group. His happens to be a good look for counteracting the fallacy of equating godlessness with vice. 6'2", he holds himself in a way that suggests he's apologizing for all the space he can't help but take up. Handsome, but not in a way to make the squeamish consider indeterminate sexual orientations, Cass's essential niceness is written all over him. He's got a strong jaw, a high ovoid forehead from which his floppy reddish hair is only just slightly receding, and the sweetest, most earnest to the point of goofy smile this side of Oral Roberts University. Is this a man who could possibly go out and commit murder and mayhem, rape our virgin daughters, and shoot controlled substances into his veins? For decades, he'd all but owned psychology of religion, but only because nobody else really wanted it. Not anyone with the smarts to do academic research in psychology and the ambition to follow through. It had been impossible to get grants, and the prestigious journals wouldn't give him the time of day. The undergraduates crowded his courses, but that counted, if anything, as a strike against him in his department. The graduate students stayed away in droves. The mind is a computer, and the guys with the algorithms ruled. But now things had happened. Fundamental and fundamentalist things, and religion as a phenomenon is on everybody's mind. And among all the changes that religion's new towering profile has wrought in the world, which are mostly alarming, if not downright terrifying, is the transformation in the life of one Cass Seltzer. It was a bold and audacious move, not the sort of thing, in other words, you'd expect from Cass Seltzer, that had prompted him to concoct in a frenzy of focus and erotic ambition his book, The Varieties of Religious Delusion. The title, a play on that masterpiece in the psychology of religion, William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience. You would have thought that Cass's timing in producing a book that argues the intellectual hollowness of religion was maybe impeccable, that he had taken the direction of the wind and realized that the flames of zealotry had swept them scorchingly in his direction, but nothing could be further from the truth. Cass has no sense of timing, nothing of the sort. When Cass, in all the safety of his obscurity, set about writing a book that would take on one by one all the arguments for God, and mind you, not just the organized arguments of philosophers, but the sort of the most motively charged vagaries that philosophers don't deign to touch with a 10-foot piece of chalk, he'd really had no idea of the massive response his efforts would provoke. Like many a male specimen of many a species, Cass has become something larger than himself in the hope of attracting a female's attention. Think the Argentine drake, for example, which measures a mere 16 inches and weighs barely a pound, and yet manages to flaunt a corkscrew penis that is a full inch longer than itself. Or think, to change examples from gross anatomy to extended phenotype, of the male bowerbird of New Guinea, which constructs the most elaborate of nests, decorating it with scavenged ornaments, shells, feathers, bits of aluminum foil, sometimes using a dipstick to apply chewed up berries to give the place a nice coat of color. And all this just to get a female to stop by and inspect the premises, perchance to venture inside with the male bowerbird taking it from there. If winning the love of Lucinda Mandelbaum has required an extended phenotype of such extraordinary dimensions as writing a runaway bestseller now being translated into 17 languages, including Latvian, it's no wonder, since Lucinda Mandelbaum is herself of such extraordinary dimensions. No wonder that in trying to get Lucinda to take him seriously, Cass had unintentionally netted a substantial share of the reading public. The goddess of game theory had all but snorted when he first told her what his area of expertise was. Now, let's be perfectly honest here. Lucinda had snorted when Cass told her that his interest was in religion. Religion? The phenomenology of religion, yet, what the religious point of view feels like from the inside? Who cares? That's the sort of gassy stuff that belongs to the old flatulent psychology, bloated on metaphysics, in need of a good strong purge from the sciences. Lucinda eventually confessed to Cass that she'd never even been able to figure out for the life of her why religion should have any place at all at the academic table. The fact that there were religion departments simply baffled her. Why not astrology and alchemy, chiromancy and necromancy? When she had been an undergraduate at Harvard, she'd been outraged to learn that Harvard University actually had a divinity school. How could they live with that and still claim Veritas as their motto? So no wonder she'd snorted. Lucinda's had been the snort that had launched a 70,000-unit first printing. Cass's agent, with his uncanny nose for intellectual property, hadn't hesitated at all in accepting Cass as a client, even though the past season had brought a glut of godlessness onto the book market. Maybe the agent had sensed that Cass Seltzer was a different species of non-believer, with an uncanny sense of the inner world of believers. Time magazine, in its cover story on organized irreligion and the new atheism, had ended its article by dubbing Seltzer the atheist with a soul. His agent had called to congratulate him. Now that you're famous, even I might have to start taking you seriously. The truth is, and really, what's the good of a man contemplating a frozen world at 4 a.m. if no truth-telling ensues, that Cass's heroic attempt to flog the stuffing out of that sense of mystery beclouding one's clear apprehension of the world seems to him itself a bit mysterious. After all, Cass is no philosopher. Standing out in inhuman temperatures at 4 a.m. and contemplating the meaning of one's life does not a philosopher make. So how to explain, what he'd managed to pull off? How to explain those 33 arguments for the existence of God, see appendix, all of them formally constructed in the preferred analytic mode, premises parading with military precision and every shirking presupposition and sketchy implication forced out into the open and subjected to rigorous inspection. Cass had started out with the standard arguments for God's existence, the ones discussed in philosophy classes and textbooks. The cosmological argument, number one, the ontological argument, number two, the teleological argument, number three, the arguments for mysticism and for miracles and for morality, number 11, number 13, number 15, respectively. But Cass had gone beyond the standard theological arguments, which have received, starting with the European Enlightenment until this day, more analysis than all the neurotics on all the therapeutic couches the world over. What Cass had wanted to do, what Cass apparently really had done, was to extend the centuries' worth of philosophical analysis to looser arguments for God's existence, including, but not restricted to, the new batch of theological arguments recently whipped up by the intelligent design crowd, to wit, The argument from irreducible complexity, number 4 prime. The argument from the paucity of benign mutations, number 4 double prime. This is how I got 33. The argument from the original replicator, where did DNA come from, 4 triple prime. And the argument from the strong anthropic principle, number 5, and also the argument from the strong anthropic principle with quantum weirdness thrown in. But even beyond this, and here was where the real soul of his book, Delusion, lay, he'd attempted to press into genuine arguments those intuitions that are often powerfully evocative, but too subsyllogistic to be paid much mind to by philosophers. He had tried to capture under the net of analytic reason those fleeting shadows cast by unseen winged things darting through the thick foliage of their religious sensibility. So, for example, Cass had formulated the argument from uncanny cosmic coincidence, number 20, appealing to such facts as these, that the diameter of the moon as seen from the sun is the same as the diameter of the sun as seen from the earth, which is why we can have those spectacular eclipses when the corona of the sun is revealed in all its glory. Uncanny cosmic coincidence. And so, too, he had formulated the argument from sublimity, number 24, trying to unearth a line of reasoning that might have gotten, say, a Francis Collins from the sight of a trinitized frozen waterfall to the conclusion that, quote, God is God, that Christ is his son, and that I am giving my life to that belief, unquote. For the right observer, the tri-arched cathedral etched out in the ice beneath Cass right now might yield a similar transcendence. Of all the 33 arguments for the existence of God he tried to reconstruct, it was the argument from the improbable self, number 19, to which he felt he'd done the least justice, trying to squeeze out premises from that sense of paradox he knew all too intimately, to construct something semi-coherent from out of that vertiginous step outside himself that would follow upon his staring too long at the improbable fact of his being identical with himself. Here he is, just this thing. Nobody can do it any better. The perfect realization of Cass Seltzerness. If somebody hasn't experienced this particular sort of metaphysical seizure for himself, then it's hard to find the words to give a sense of what it's like. Cass had experienced it even as a boy, lying in bed and thinking his way into the strangeness of being just this. It was almost a kind of game he'd invented, a sport at which he was actually good, even if it was only existential sport. He felt it always gave him a good workout. Afterwards, his heart would be pounding as if he'd run for miles. Cass had the lower bunk bed. Both he and Jesse, his younger brother, had wanted the higher bunk. But as usual, Jesse had wanted what he wanted with so much more than Cass had wanted it, with a fury of need that was exhausting just to watch, that Cass had let it go. Lying there awake on his lower bunk, Cass would think about being himself rather than being Jesse. There was Jesse, and here was Cass. But if someone were looking at the two of them, Jesse there, Cass here, how could that person tell that he, Cass, was Cass here and not Jesse there? If it got switched on them, everything the same about them, only now he was Jesse there, and here was Cass there, how would anybody know? How would he know? How would Jesse? Maybe a switch had already happened. Maybe it happened again and again. How could anybody tell? The longer he tried to get a fix on the fact of being Cass here, the more the whole idea of it just got away from him. If he tried long enough to grasp it, then he could get the fact of being Cass here to blank out of existence and then just come dribbling weakly back in, like a fluorescent fixture flickering on and off toward death. A sense of giddiness induced by these ontological exercises could be a bit too overwhelming for a kid in a lower bunk bed. It could be a bit overwhelming still. Here I am, Cass is saying, standing on Weeks Bridge and talking to the night. Cass knows he needs to tamp down his tendencies toward the transcendental. It isn't becoming in America's favorite atheist, who is at this moment Cass Seltzer, who is somehow or other just this here. Here I am. How can it be that of all things, one is this thing, so that one can say astonishingly, in the right frame of mind, it is astonishing, with the metaphysical chill blowing in from afar, here I am. When you didn't force yourself to think in formal reconstructions, when you didn't chop up these moments of ravishments into premises and conclusions, labeled and analyzed like so many splayed butterflies, crushing the transcendental glow right out of them, then what? It's even hard at a time like this to resist the shameful, narcissistic appeal of the argument from benign personal destiny, number 30. Hard to resist the sense that though William James is no doubt right in rebuking the scoundrel logic that calculates from one's own goodie bag of games, and though that the brains who had discussed this in the Rialto the other night had argued that there's no reason to think that cosmic destiny must curve upward, still, for Cass Seltzer, it has curved upward, upward beyond all compass or comprehension. And call him a scoundrel for feeling personally grateful to the universe when at this same moment that he's standing on Weeks Bridge and tossing hosannas out into the infinite universe, there are multitudes of others whose lives are painfully constricting with misfortunes that are just as arbitrary and undeserved as his own expansive good luck. But Cass Seltzer does feel grateful. And when the various arguments start mounting up together, first singly, but then merging with one another, when the premises and conclusions become fused in one pressing sense of ravishing immensity so that you feel as one, the argument from the necessity of necessity and uncanny coincidence and sublimity and the hard problem of consciousness and benign destiny and the improbable self and answered prayers, then what? Here I am. At moments like this, could Cass altogether withstand the sense that, how hard to put it into words, the sense that the universe is personal, that there is something personal that grounds existence in order and value and purpose and meaning, and that the grandeur of that personal universe has somehow infiltrated and is expanding his own small person, bringing his littleness more in line with its grandeur, that the personal universe has been personally kind to him, gracious and forgiving to Cass Seltzer, gratuitously, exorbitantly, divinely kind, and this despite Cass's having, with callowness and shallowness of forethought, thrown spitballs at the whole idea of cosmic intentionality. No, this doesn't capture it either. This sentiment is far too narrowed by the contents of Cass's own particular life, when what it is he could feel, has felt, might even be feeling, has nothing to do with the data of Cass's own existence, but rather with existence itself, this expansion out into the world, which is a kind of love, he supposes, a love for the whole of existence that could so easily well up in Cass Seltzer at this moment, standing here in the pure abstractions of this night and contemplating the strange thisness of his life when viewed sub specia eternitatis, that is to say, from the vantage point of eternity that comes so highly recommended to us by Spinoza. And it would be possible, were he to yield to it, to feel grateful to the universe for his life, that it could have answered his love with this love. It's hard not to, but even this gratitude, even if he were to give way to it, which he's not, doesn't capture what it is he could almost feel. Here it is, then, the sense that existence is just such a tremendous thing. One comes into it astonishingly. Here one is, formed by biology and history, genes and culture, in the midst of the contingency of the world, here one is. One doesn't know how, one doesn't know why, and suddenly, one doesn't know where one is either or what one is either, and all that one knows is that one is a part of it, a conscious part of it, generated and sustained in existence in ways one can hardly comprehend, all the time conscious of it, though, of existence, the fullness of it, the reaching expanse and pulsing intricacy of it, and one wants to live in a way that at least begins to do justice to it. One wants to expand one's reach of it as far as expansion is possible, and even beyond that, to live one's life in a way commensurate with the privilege of being a part of and conscious of the whole swelling, reeling, glorious, infinite, eternal sweep. A sweep that includes so improbably, a psychologist of religion named Cass Seltzer, who, moved by powers beyond himself, did something more improbable than all the improbabilities constituting his improbable existence could have predicted, did something that won him someone else's life, a better life, a more brilliant life, a life beyond all the ones he'd wished for in the pounding obscurity of his yearnings, because all of this couldn't belong to him, to the man who stands on Weeks Bridge, wrapped around in a scarf his once beloved ex-wife Pascal had knit for him for some necessary reason he would never know, perhaps to offer him some protection against the desolation she knew would soon be his and was, but is no longer, suspended here above sublimity, his cheeks aflame with either euphoria or frostbite, a letter in his zippered pocket with the imprimatur of Veritas, and a Lucinda Mandelbaum. A Lucinda Mandelbaum with whom to share it all. Thank you.